Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, we're joined by Roland Dye. He's from Trident Ploughshares, where the idea being to melt down those swords and make them into ploughshares. Well, that's the plan anyway, to stop wars. But he's running something next weekend, that's Sunday the 15th of July, a very unique picnic lunch, a tour of Bristol's arms manufacturers. Also, US Army officer, well, former US Army officer, Scott Bennett. He used to work for something called CENTCOM, that's Central Command. And he describes the various countries that they were controlling, well, at least trying to control, through the US military means when he was working for them. That's all over the Middle East, basically. And we speak to him about many other things, including his recent conversations with intelligence officers over in Tehran. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Dr. Roland Dye because I've got a PhD in physics. I can claim to be a nuclear scientist or former nuclear scientist. And I'm here to talk about an action which was called Breaking the Chain.
Well, before you do that, tell us about your work. What did you do as a nuclear scientist? It's not everyone that you meet in the bus queue that says that they're a nuclear scientist, is it?
Well, everyone's done interesting things over their life. But I grew up here in Bristol. I was told at school I was good at physics. We could talk longer about why these sort of things happen in your youth, where the state is deciding what trained people it needs in the next generation of workers. Went off to university and did physics. And then they sit you in lecture theatres and they tell you all about nuclear power and how wonderful and absolutely faultless it all is, and nuclear weapons and how they work, how they explode, how they kill people, how human beings die of radiation and that sort of thing.
And how it's kept the peace for such a long time.
Oh, that will be there somewhere. But it's all perfectly safe and logical, and we're the good guys because we've got them and we never do anything bad with them. You're getting my angle on it's propaganda, it's grooming, it's indoctrination.
So what did you actually do then in your career as a nuclear scientist?
I managed to avoid all that stuff, and I actually went in for a beneficial use of radioactivity, which is in hospitals called nuclear medicine, diagnostic tests.
Is that x-rays or something like that?
It's like x-rays, but where they send a tracer, you inject a tracer into the bloodstream and it will show the physiological, the function of some organ system.
Sounds quite safe if you can inject it into you.
It everything has a certain amount of harm. X-ray pictures do a little bit of damage, but if you want the doctors to save your life, then they've got to find out what's wrong with you. So I judge that as being beneficial to humankind.
Okay, so what about this Breaking the Chains protest in London on the 20th of June?
I'll just butt in and say, at a personal level, I've recently made contact with two people from my youth, somebody from my school days and somebody from my university days, and sometimes you don't get a lot of choice in life, and these two folks ended up working in the arms industry. So maybe it was a narrow escape for me, and I just managed to duck out of that in time.
Well, I don't think anyone is actually going to force you to work in the arms industry. It's a choice people make. Obviously, there's some financial inducements.
Yes, the offer of a good life with a regular salary, a good life, and so on and so forth. But overall, we, the workers, don't get to decide what jobs are on offer.
You okay, just have to pick and choose. What about the protest then?
Right, the protest was a group that I've worked with for some years now called Trident Ploughshares. And two or three times a year, they might do an unannounced action. So on this particular day up in London, we turned up outside the Parliament building. And there's a very ornate and beautiful set of wrought iron railings outside. And we chained and padlocked ourselves to those railings in the style of the suffragettes protests a century before. But we were there to protest against nuclear weapons.
And your banner, I'm trying to read it here, it says something about sign the treaty. What treaty?
Yes, well, the treaty was one that was agreed by the United Nations about this time last year, July 2017. And I'll remind your listeners that not all the countries in the world have nuclear weapons. In fact, a tiny minority of only nine countries.
Okay, do you want to name those nine?
Yes, the countries that possess nuclear weapons are ourselves, the United Kingdom, America, France, Israel, Pakistan, India, Russia, China, and North Korea. But that's only 9 countries out of nearly 200 countries throughout the whole world. So you can see the vast majority don't have nuclear weapons, and very many of them think they're a bad idea.
Well, don't some countries secretly have nuclear weapons?
There's a question mark over Iran. South Africa did, but they got rid of them. That's about the end of the story.
Well, because the Israelis won't confirm or deny whether they've got nuclear weapons, but they clearly have got nuclear weapons. It's been leaked many times. And in fact, some of their professors have even threatened to, I think it was Martin van Creveld actually threatened to nuke European cities. He said if the Europeans don't behave themselves, we could always nuke them. So it does suggest that maybe they have got nuclear weapons. The problem here being that under United States law, they cannot supply any money, any aid to a country that has nuclear weapons outside of the treaties, which the Israelis do. So there seems to be a bit of a hypocrisy there. The United States is sending billions to Israel, and yet it's not allowed to.
Well, absolutely right. It is a hypocrisy, and our country doesn't have clean hands either, because Britain and France both supplied elements of nuclear technology to Israel, because that's how they did it. So they have about 80 nuclear warheads. You know, that's approaching the number that this country has, and it's clearly outrageous, and they refuse to acknowledge that they exist at all.
Is that all? 80?
According to the list that I've seen.
I wonder, though, because a lot of this stuff is so secret, it's almost impossible to know, isn't it? Anyway, look, what about British nuclear weapons? They're the ones we're supposed to be responsible for. Trident, what is it?
Yes, Trident is a weapon system based upon 4 submarines which are berthed up in Scotland at a port called Faslane. And each submarine has 8 rockets, let's call them, and each rocket has something like 5 independently steerable British-made nuclear warheads, and each one of those is 8 times the power.
Well, I'd call it a missile, because they're guided, aren't they?
Yeah, okay. Sub-missiles. And each one of those warheads is up to 8 times the destructive power of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So you do the sums, one submarine can kill nearly 50 million people. That's colossal.
But the last time they tried to fire one, I seem to remember,
it went in the wrong direction.
It went off towards America.
Well,
and
lot
I wonder
of
whether these
we can ask about the
someone
safety
was
and
hacking the submarine and having a bit of a laugh with the Royal Navy at their expense by sending the missile over towards Florida.
Well, there's a lot of questions I'd like to ask now about the safety. And one of the questions is to your listeners, do you know where Britain's nuclear bomb factory is? Long pause. This is the stuff of party stand-up comedy, because it works particularly well for Bristol people. If have you ever travelled along the M4 to London? Well, everyone nods their head. So just after you pass Reading Services, look to your right. 2 fields from the motorway, you can see a cluster of low grey buildings. That's the final assembly point for Britain's nuclear warheads. Yes, 1 mile south of the M4 near Reading. It is a nuclear bomb
factory.
So that's
if you're heading towards London. But then there's also Welford, isn't there, which is this, I think it says works unit only. That's on the left-hand side if you're heading towards London.
I'm glad somebody else here has an acute sense of geography.
I think I saw it on one of the Mark Thomas programmes, actually. I'll confess. He was going on all sorts of places that he wasn't supposed to go, bless him.
Yep, and that's Europe's largest heavy munitions store. So the M4 has got a lot of nasties.
Is it American or is it British, Welford?
Well, I remember during the war on Iraq, the last war on Iraq, they were American bombs brought over by sea, put onto trucks, driven around the motorways, stockpiled there, with very lax security, by the way.
And that's probably not a good truck to crash into as you're driving down the motorway.
Well, people might be wondering if they actually make the warheads in Berkshire, how do they get them up to Scotland? And the answer is on armed convoys on public roads.
Ah, notice you've got a leaflet there which has got something called Nuke Watch on it, nukewatch.org.uk. Now, I can remember many years ago having a lot of fun leaning out of a car window, being driven by a lovely old lady and filming these nuclear convoys as they go by. What's the point? Why was I doing that? I think it was simply because we felt that we wanted to be able to do it and we wanted to exercise our freedom to do it. And actually, the army didn't really seem to mind.
No, they're secret, but you're right. A lot of people have seen them, and your listeners only have to go onto YouTube and just type that in. They can find numerous videos detailing these convoys. After all, they go up and down the country about six times a year.
And Nuke Watch is an interesting little group, isn't it? Because when one of these things gets spotted by someone who's part of the group, so you don't actually ever have to go chasing one of these, just be part of the group. And if you ever spot one of these, you get a kind of little bit of info about what they look like. You can just ring through, and so others can then go and follow it and film it. But ultimately, though, what is the point?
The point is to make visible something that the government tries to just quietly keep secret. And I commend the work of these very dedicated people, because pretty well every time a convoy leaves Scotland or leaves Berkshire, it's being tracked. And what is the point? Well, the concern to us is nothing on the road is 100% safe. You know, vehicles do crash. In fact, the official log of incidents in 2017 was over 40 incidents. And these could be like minor things like a tire bursting, electrical faults, overheating, breaking down, getting lost even. And of course, as we
using the sat nav, if the front car is on its sat nav, you don't really want a nuclear convoy coming squeezing through your little village.
And Bristol people will know that when there's high winds, high-sided vehicles aren't supposed to use the first Severn crossing. And up in Scotland, they've got a similar bridge. And yet one time it's reported that the convoy actually went across when there was gale force winds. And what would happen if there was an accident?
Answer your own question.
Well, bearing in mind, a warhead is an assembly of conventional explosives and several kilograms of plutonium. So supposing that convoy crashed into a fuel tanker, a truck that caught fire, it does happen sometimes on the motorway. You've then got a fire with several kilograms of plutonium. The explosives could go off and scatter that over quite a large area. So supposing that happened in a built-up area.
It's not likely to explode actually as a nuclear bomb.
No, more as a conventional explosion, scattering.
But what they call a dirty bomb.
A dirty bomb, or plutonium dust cloud. And plutonium is the most dangerous substance on the planet. You cannot clean that sort of mess up. And yet they're doing this six times a year, and basically they're flagrantly disregarding public safety.
Okay, one of the protests you've been doing, Trident Ploughshares, is it to do with Burfield? What is Burfield?
Just before we move off the subject of the convoy, I'm showing you a photograph here of what happened in 1987 when it was a very frosty night and one of the trucks slid off the road on the Oxford Ring Road or something like that. And there's a photograph of it lying on its side in the ditch. That's just snatched off. You can find that on the internet.
There was no nuclear bomb explosion there.
They're not going to tell us. There could well have been. It didn't explode.
The truck is still in one piece.
We can see the truck on its side. Yes, obviously this is dangerous. So back to Burfield. So what can a plucky little group of campaigners who feel this is a terrible danger, that Britain has got an immoral and genocidal weapon system, what can one do? Well, Burfield Nuclear Bomb Factory is actually quite easy to blockade. So I've got some photographs here of what happened one sunny June about 3 years ago, where vehicles turned up at strategic road junctions and people locked on. This is what's called non-violent direct action, and actually obstructed the entire morning shift that several thousand workers going into work that day. This is sending a signal to the powers that be and the government that there are citizens who believe passionately enough that what is going on is wrong, and they're willing to put themselves and their bodies and their liberty on the line. There's lots of other actions that could be done. I took part in a nearly nude protest outside the gates of Burfield, which generated some interesting local publicity. But none of these things ever get into the nationals. It's rather strange. I don't mean the nearly nude protest. I mean actually closing down a nuclear bomb factory for most of a day.
What about Wool Against Weapons? What's that?
Yes, an amazing creative woman up in Stroud had the idea that because there's actually two halves to the nuclear bomb factory. There's Aldermaston that people have really heard of because of the famous marches, and Burfield, which does the final assembly and dispatch. They're about 7 miles apart. And what can you do with two halves of a factory that's 7 miles apart? Let's try and link them up with something. Why not have a 7 mile long pink peace scarf? Wow. And of course, that's something of a step into the unknown, because nobody knows if there is the human capability to knit a 7 mile long pink peace scarf. It took about 2 years all around the country. People were working hard, knitting them in sort of panels the size of a small blanket. And they were sewn together and it worked. And in fact, it was just a tad over the 7 miles and it completed the complete connection between the two halves. Politicians came along and made speeches. Lots of campaigners waved flags. That was done. We do what we can to expose the wrongs that are going on.
I think, you know, one of the best things I've ever seen to do with the whole nuclear industry was a BBC series back in 1986, and I think it was, written by Troy Kennedy Martin, the guy that wrote and invented the Sweeney programme, which was much more famous, but it was called The Edge of Darkness. And if anyone's not seen it, do please have a look at it. Bits of it are on YouTube, or you can get the DVD from the BBC or BFI or whatever it is. Well worth a look, because they go into the real dangers of the nuclear industry in a great way. And also, the fact is that, like all parts of the weapons industries, parts of even the nuclear industry are privatised, aren't they? For example, parts of the nuclear power industry. In fact, we're asking for lots of money from China. You know, maybe not exactly from the People's Communist Party of China, but, you know, to have Chinese money coming in to build Hinkley C.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because this is the absurdity that's going on, that if Britain didn't have nuclear weapons, it would be doing what other European countries like Germany are doing, which is switching off their nuclear power stations because they're expensive and they leave a toxic residue of unmanageable nuclear waste. And Germany, for example, is very successfully gradually switching over to renewables.
So do you think Hinkley C will ever be built? I think it was about 5 years ago we first heard this sort of big announcement on the BBC, oh, it's all going to happen, but it's slowly but surely we're hearing, there's no money for it.
Well, it is a massive building site down there, and they're mixing concrete every day and getting on with it, and in 10 years' time, it might be ready to work. No, it is a massive project, and it is rolling, but the decision to go ahead with that partly is because this country wants to have the next generation of nuclear weapons, and they've got to keep the skilled scientists, unlike me, and engineers, and the engineering capability to actually manufacture the new fleet of submarines up at Faslane for the new
generation.
So what's
the connection between that and Hinkley?
If this country didn't want to have nuclear weapons, they wouldn't be bothering with nuclear power, and they wouldn't be throwing our money at it to produce highly expensive electricity, which we can't afford, and to leave us with a waste of toxic waste of nuclear weapons.
Okay, the Trident nuclear missiles in these Trident submarines are American. Do we actually have any independent control over them?
The missiles are American, but the warheads are British. But you're, again, touching on a very important point.
I mean, surely the Americans can just have a veto. If they don't want us to fire a missile in a certain direction, they can just press the kill button, a bit like James Bond or something. They can say no.
It must be exactly like that, because Britain boasts that it's got an independent nuclear deterrent, except the important bit in the middle is American, and they're probably in charge of the guidance system. So it is inconceivable that this country could go off and launch an attack on its own or for its own purposes.
But what about,
the whole thing is riddled with inconsistencies.
What about Dicey? What's that?
Going back to this group that I'm working with called Trident Ploughshares, it was one of many groups of brave people who decided to protest against the well-known arms fair, which comes around every 2 years in East London. Because, and you mentioned privatisation, all the nuclear weapons system now is actually run by private companies, and those private companies are in the arms industry.
Hang on, nuclear weapons systems? Private?
Yes.
Surely, I mean, that's crazy.
Burfield, Aldermaston, these are actually run by private companies. Just up the road in Filton, the massive MOD procurement centre is a private organisation now.
Good.
I know, it's jaw-dropping, isn't it?
It is. It's shocking, really, to think that private business is getting these contracts. Of course, that makes it much, much more difficult for MPs or us to scrutinise what they're up to.
Well, you may well have heard that there was a contract out to decommission the first generation of nuclear reactors in this country, which were called Magnox. And either because the government wrote the contract so badly, or hidden within that was unacceptable technical difficulties to the companies, or the companies were making a mess of it, the government then had to take that contract back from those private companies who had the job of decommissioning, the very important task of decommissioning these old and still glowing radioactive sites on nuclear power stations, and had to bung in over £120 million as a sort of severance deal to get that contract back. And that's what happens with privatisation. Yes, it's all crazy.
Okay, what about arms companies in Bristol? Are there any?
Well, in fact, all the companies that are involved with the private production running of these nuclear facilities all have offices in North Bristol. So names like Lockheed Martin, names like Babcock, Rolls-Royce, who make the reactors for the propulsion of the submarines, the list goes on, all have a presence in North Bristol. And that's why I'm also involved in a campaign called Bristol Against the Arms Trade. And in fact, coming up soon, we have an awareness-raising event, which is to lead a walking tour around these sites in North Bristol. So on Sunday, the 15th of July, we call it the Bristol Arms Walk. There's got to be comedic possibilities or a lighthearted touch there. And
are you supposed to come with your Kalashnikov and, maybe...
No, just a pack of sandwiches for your picnic lunch, and we will be picnicking on the grass outside the massive MOD building.
How about your terrorist balaclava? Can you bring that?
Well, sometimes this stuff is so absurd that I have to go, shh, don't tell the terrorists. A bit like the nuclear waste train that comes through Templemead Station at about 4 o'clock every Wednesday afternoon, bringing the used fuel rods from Hinckley.
Don't stand too close to it, folks. I was standing close to that.
Don't tell the terrorists they might do something silly.
Is it serious? I mean, you can actually feel the radiation coming off this thing. I mean, those fuel rods, when they've been in a pond for a year, cooling down, they're still so radioactive. You can feel them through this, whatever it is, nearly a foot of lead flask. Don't go anywhere near the thing. If you see one of these brown trains with these, well, it's cream-coloured with these... cream-coloured flask with a brown flatbed train. Just get out of the
step
basically.
As far as you can, yeah. Well, back to the arms companies in North Bristol. These are mostly offices. Rolls-Royce have got a large manufacturing facility. But we'll be leading this walk. Shall I announce the details? We'll be meeting at 10 o'clock on Sunday, the 15th of July, down on the centre to get the bus 70 or 71 up to the UE campus. Or meet us there at the bus stops at 11 a.m. and then we'll be doing a 2-hour walking tour. It's about 2 or 3 miles, all on publicly accessible footpaths. And as I mentioned, having a picnic lunch outside the MOD procurement centre. It's all very beautiful. It's got lakes and birds and bushes and trees and so on and so forth. But don't touch the fence because the cops will come running out thinking you're some sort of terrorist.
Is it electrified?
No, it's a very modest fence because they rely upon their moat, their lake, as part of their defence. They want it to look beautiful. And, of course, that's all part of the propaganda game that goes on.
So you're
going
to be coming in your scuba diving gear, are you?
Well, maybe not this time. But look upon this as a sort of interesting, wacky tourist attraction. Where else can you pass by 2 dozen arms companies in less than 2 hours and have a nice picnic lunch on some grass?
Only here in Bristol, folks. Anyway, Roland Dye, thanks very much for joining us.
Great. Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Scott Bennett, and I'm a former United States Army psychological warfare officer who worked at the State Department and U.S. Central Command in terrorist financing. And I also worked in the Bush administration from 2003 to 2008.
Sorry, Scott, but you say in terrorist financing. Does that mean that CENTCOM were financing terrorists?
Well, that certainly is an ironic ring of truth. But no, formally, I was working for the counter-financing of terrorism operations at U.S. Central Command. U.S. Central Command runs all of the military operations in Iraq, Syria, all of the Middle East, essentially. And my work was countering the terrorist financing that people in the Middle East, wealthy donors and financiers in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, were sending to finance jihadis used in mercenary operations in Syria and Libya and elsewhere.
I mean, so groups like ISIS obviously need a lot of money to keep functioning, and they can't function without it. They're having to pay mercenaries, they're having to buy guns, ammunition, transport, all that sort of thing. It's an expensive business waging a war like ISIS did. Well, if you can, in a nutshell, tell us, where are the main conduits for that cash?
Well, that's, you know, that's the sad irony that we see, because we believe that all of the military and all of the U.S. intelligence agencies were fighting on the same side, and that is a lie. They're not. The U.S. CIA and Mossad have been backing what you could call the Saudi Arabian mercenary bad guys, and the U.S. Pentagon and the military were fighting those same bad guys. And it's easy to say we drop a pallet of weapons out the back of a C-130 as we fly over the desert, but instead of getting to the, quote, new Syrian army or whoever the United States Congress has been deceived into backing, they drop down and are given into the hands of the al-Nusra Front or the al-Qaeda or whatever you want to call them, ISIS, Daesh. They all follow the same flag. They all have the same ideological Wahhabism beliefs of fanatical intolerance for anything that's not a Wahhabist.
It might be a bit of a shortcut, but is it fair to say that these kinds of terrorist, jihadi, mercenary types will fight for whoever pays them the most?
Well, they will, because they're semi-retarded. First of all, intellectually, spiritually, morally, emotionally, these are a retarded, violent, savage people that have been abused, and I mean they're really sociopathic in many regards, and they've been cast into this environment and brainwashed to a large extent by the Mossad, by the Israeli Mossad, dual Israeli Saudi Arabian blooded people, and we saw them in Libya. So the Israelis have a whole intelligence operation brainwashing these people and turning them into kamikazes, essentially, and then sending them up into Syria and elsewhere to fight for the greater jihad, fight for, you know, expanding Wahhabist Islam. And if they die in the process, they go right to paradise and get 72 virgins and 9 prepubescent boys to sexually gratify them alongside rivers of alcohol for all of their days.
Your classical Muslim. But anyway, look, you're a military man. I just want you to gaze into the crystal ball for a minute. What do you make of what's happening in Syria? Because large parts of the country still haven't been taken back by President Assad's government and the Syrian Arab army. There are chunks, aren't there, that are still controlled, for example, by the Turks and the Kurds. And it doesn't look as if they're going to be going home anytime soon.
Well, that's the problem, is that the United States and Israel have backed these pockets of resistance to try and maintain a footprint in Syria. And I think it's a war crime. I think it should be challenged and prosecuted as a war crime. Any foreign troops that are on Syrian soil are invaders. And the Russian and the Iranian troops that are there by invitation. It's quite simple. And Syria is a sovereign, autonomous nation, just like the United Kingdom, just like the United States, just like Germany, just like any nation. So either they're sovereign or they're not. And right now, the only countries that seem to respect the sovereignty and the idea of stable environments is Russia, Iran, China and Syria, and certainly some countries in Europe that are waking up to this fact. The countries that are pushing instability and violence and chaos has been the United States and Israel, with France towing the line, I think, and the United Kingdom towing the line. But they're not about anything stable. And when I was over in Iran, we met with intelligence officials that were showing us all sorts of interesting facts and figures about Wahhabists that were coming up into Syria and then were flown out by the United States and then shuttled up to Afghanistan. The whole reality check that I saw about the United States actively playing a part in empowering, protecting, medicalizing, arming, these mercenaries is a disgusting contradiction and act of, I think, unconstitutional hypocrisy.
Okay, so look,
we're funding the guys that our soldiers are told to fight.
You've just come back not long ago from Iran. Can you just paint us a picture of, you know, what you were up to there, and for those that have never visited the country, what it's like?
Well, Iran is a wonderful country, wonderful people. It is not the boogeyman we've been led to believe. The propaganda is all lies. They are a very smart, very gentle and peaceful and calm people. They reminded me of Indians, if you will, or Hare Krishnas without the, you know, with the bald head. These are very, very mellow people, and they're not about antagonizing or making war on the West. They're not about making nuclear bombs to use against Israel. All of that is propaganda that is being fomented to try and justify a Western military action against Iran.
Did you not see
the Israelis
any of these?
Are pushing.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of these protests, because there have been some protests on the street recently. Massive rising prices. People can hardly afford to feed their families.
Well, I wouldn't say it's as bad as that. I was in the streets of Mashhad, and I saw a couple of the protests, and it wasn't against the government. It was against the JCPOA pullout, which I think I understand why Trump did it, and I recommended to the Iranians that they reach out to Trump aggressively and say, we understand that you're dumping everything Obama did, and we have some problems with the JCPOA too. So we're happy to make a new deal as long as we get what we want, and don't think for a second we're going to surrender anything. The Iranian nation and the Iranian government and people are quite satisfied with the way things are going. There is no great disruption. There is no feeling of oppression amongst the people. They're a very, very Shia Muslim country and people, very traditional, very stable, and there are no uprisings. There are no discontented parades or anything like that that maybe the West is being led to believe. I mean, I was in Mashhad, I was in Tehran, I was on state TV, Iranian state TV. I was giving talks to universities, amongst many others. I was there with Peter Van Buren and Phil Giraldi and Michael Maloof and J. Michael Springman and an assortment of other people from the West.
Tell me a bit more about these intelligence briefings you were getting. I mean, that's one of the most fascinating, I imagine, peeps behind the curtain for somebody like yourself, who was former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, is to get a bit of inside insight from Iranian intelligence. Very few people in the West get a chance to do that.
Yeah, it was a very wonderful experience to sit down and talk with them about what was going on in Syria, what's going on in Yemen, what's the real story behind 9/11.
Well, let's talk about Yemen. Let's talk about Yemen for a minute, because this, we know, is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world at the moment.
Yes.
It's also the biggest outbreak of cholera ever in modern era. And so what's your view of why that war is happening? Because I mean, for many people looking at it on the TV, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. Saudi aircraft, British bombs, British planes, American bombs, American planes, just bombing. Now they've run out of military targets. They're just bombing houses, weddings, funerals, anything.
Yeah. Well, the British and the Americans are schizophrenic in their foreign policy. They're schizophrenic in their morality. They want to sell weapons and make a lot of money on one hand, and then they claim to care about human rights on the other hand. And you can't really do that and cancel out your actions and your belief, which is what's happening. And the Saudi Arabians look at Yemen like just a bunch of savages and animals that need to be put into a corral and branded and used as fodder. Or they're the primitives, if you will. The Saudi Arabians, especially under King bin Salman, are looking at Yemen as a country that they want to crush and redominate and institute a puppet regime so that they're in absolute control. And that's what the Houthis have overthrown and are wanting their absolute independence and autonomy. And the Saudi Arabians have waged this war against them. It's similar to Vietnam, quite honestly. Saudi Arabia is like the United States was in Vietnam. And the Yemenis are being helped. And they're not getting really missiles or anything from Iran. They're finding a lot of the missiles that were left behind in the country of Yemen. So the West is trying to say that the Iranians are playing a big part. They're really not. They're not playing any part other than trying to be humanitarian aid providers and such. But You're exactly right, Tony. It's a human catastrophe. It is a biological warfare environment. And Saudi Arabia should be filed as a war criminal nation and be charged with war crimes because they're waging biological warfare. They're waging cholera epidemics. They're cutting off the food and water supply. They're destroying the medical provisions. They're destroying hospitals. And they're waging a war of terrorism. And I'm amazed that the world doesn't have enough courage or brain power to see this.
Well,
and really
I think many people do. It's just that the press are simply not explaining it. And one thing I'd like to try and explain now, if I can, is some of the geography of the Arabian Peninsula, because the British and the French created Saudi Arabia and the Sykes-Picot Agreement after the First World War. And they drew a line right through the middle of the Arabian Peninsula between Yemen and what is now Saudi Arabia. And actually, they were originally, I mean, many of the people were nomadic, but effectively they were the same country. Now, what I'd suggest to you, and I don't know what you make of this, is that potentially this war really is to disable any potential opposition within the Arabian Peninsula to the Saudis, because their position as a royal family supported by the West is becoming less tenable by the day.
Yeah, I think you're right. They're strangling for power. I think they're on the edge of a coup d'etat. I think bin Salman and the Saudi family are on the verge of being overthrown and having done to them what they tried to do to Syria. I think the Saudi Arabian ruling kingdom is very near to being overthrown into an internal civil war. And quite frankly, I can't imagine a better country that it happens to, because the Saudi Arabian House of Al Saud and this Wahhabi menace that has been infecting Europe and being pushed as a pawn in this great chess game and has really given Islam a horrifically bad name that it does not deserve. And I think the Iranians and the Syrians are a better representation of Islam. And I know there's a lot of Christians and Alawites. There's a lot of Christians and, in fact, many Jews living in Iran. But the Shia Muslim is a far better example of what true Islam is than this Wahhabi Saudi Arabian fanaticism. And I think you're right that the Saudis are desperately trying to crush and control the entire peninsula before they lose all, I think, connection with the West.
I mean,
or their
some, Scott, I mean, I'm not trying to teach you your own business here, but some have also said that the Saudi Arabian monarchy, Prince Salman, or, you know, he's bin Salman, he's effectively the ruler of the country, he won't use the army against the Saudi army very much against the Yemeni people, the Houthis, because if he did, there'd probably be a revolt in the army and the army might turn their tanks on him.
Well, that's a very real possibility, because when you have human engagements in tanks and infantry, then you have the susceptibility to psychological movements, and you have a transition, or you have an uprising, or you have a change, or you have the handing over of weapons, that, like they did in the Vietnam era. You had large areas of the North and South changing sides, so you could have a changing of sides. That's why it's very safe to have Air Force bombardments dropping bombs and missiles from 30,000 feet, because it's impersonal. But the problem is, you're bombing things, like you said, that are insignificant civilian targets. And YouTube and the internet today is capturing a lot of the video footage that was kept away from us earlier in earlier decades. And I think the world is at last coming to its final grinding halt to this war machine juggernaut that was started on September 11th, 2001, and that went to destroy seven countries in 5 years. I think the world has seen that come to an end, and Russia and Iran and China have sort of erected a wall of economic engines and zones, such as the Shanghai Development Corporation, the BRICS nations, the Silk Road. All of these things are gearing towards a non-petrodollar economic system, or at least an alternative system. And I think you see Europe being increasingly attracted to that. I certainly think the Eastern European countries and countries like Poland, and or not necessarily Poland, but Hungary and the Czech Republic and Slovakia and Lithuania, Latvia, Belarus, all of these former Soviet republics and countries are, I think, inclining more towards the Russian position than they are the EU position, because the EU has invited all of these hordes of refugees that have just resulted in cannibalizing the culture, the social welfare systems, destabilized a lot of the political regimes, and you have a reaction with the rise of these right-wing groups that are standing up in opposition to it. And I think that's something to be very, very cognizant of.
You probably know more about some of these characters in the United States than we do. I'm talking about people like John Bolton, Rudy Giuliani, who have been at this conference in Paris of a group called the MKO, the MEK, who are effectively a terrorist group. Now, actually, there are many Americans, including American oil executives over the year, that they have assassinated. But now, apparently, according to Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, they're no longer a terrorist group. Who are the MEK? Who are the MKO? And how come the Americans now think that they are okay? These guys are terrorists, yes, but they are our terrorists. Who are they?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I agree with you, Tony. They're our terrorists. It's very similar to what we did before the Iraq invasion in 2003. Remember, we created our alternative Iraqi parliament government leader system with al-Shalabi, and they were our guys that we were going to send in and topple Saddam Hussein, and they were going to be the new rulers of Iraq, and they were going to be the best friends of America, and suddenly we're going to get all sorts of oil and benefits that we wanted. And we're doing the same thing with this MKO. Now, the Shalabi system and these guys were pathological liars, completely lied to, Americans, and the government either was lied to or they believed the lie and wanted to believe the lie and doubled down. But the Shalabi, all of these leaders who said they were going to go into Iraq and be heralded as leaders of the new country, they were kicked out. Nobody wanted them. Nobody knew them. And the MKO is being positioned in the same way with these clowns like Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton and others, Hillary Clinton, for them to go in and attend these meetings and celebrate them as the alternative to Iran is an absolute falsity. It's a lie. No one in Iran wants them. Iran is not an unstable country.
But hang on, look, you just called them clowns, but actually Rudy Giuliani is Trump's new chief lawyer, and John Bolton is the national security advisor. They're not clowns. They're actually very major people running policy in the United States.
Well, that's the sad reality. I'm still amazed that Rudy Giuliani isn't in a war crime cell for his activities and participation in the 9/11 attacks. I mean, he was the mayor of New York, and he knew about, or agreed with, or saw, or should have seen a lot of the underhanded activities that were involved with the 9/11 attacks in New York City.
But I mean, hang on. That's a surprise attack, surely. I mean, you can't blame the mayor for it.
Well, he's in a position of power. If there's anybody in charge of a city, it's the mayor. He knows where every building is and who every person is in that building. He's the president of New York City, if you will. And Building 7 coming down, which we still have the NIST, the National Institute for Science and Technology, trying to say that it fell because of an office fire. That is the most ludicrous lie that any human being could be told, and yet we're accepting it, or most people have. They haven't even questioned it, but that is something Rudy Giuliani played a part of. So the 9/11 thing is something that Rudy Giuliani was a key role in. Now he's Trump's advisor. Now he's one of the key attorneys. I don't like that fact, but he's there, but he certainly doesn't win any points when he goes over and starts making these attacks against MKO and attacks against Iran and saying we need to do regime change. And it's like, we've just seen this bad movie. We've seen how it ends with nothing good but the loss of American lives and a loss of our reputation and a loss of our treasury. Why are we even entertaining this idea? Oh, yeah, it's because of Israel and Netanyahu and their nonsense intelligence reports where you have a bunch of CDs sitting against a wall and you call it intelligence that has been secretly obtained, showing that the Iranians have nuclear warfare ambitions. I don't think so. I think that's about as disgusting a lie as what Netanyahu and the Mossad told with the original 9/11 attacks and the dancing Israelis.
Anyway, listen, Scott, you're a former – you used to work at – CENTCOM. CENTCOM is an immensely powerful organization, a big, big force in the world, but we hardly ever hear about it. Can you just give us an insider's view of who is CENTCOM, how it fits in with U.S. Pentagon projecting power around the world?
Sure. Let me say one thing to close off the MKO thing. You may have seen this, Tony. They have said that an Iranian diplomat official was stopped in a car and explosive devices were found in the car. Now, the Iranians have said that's a false flag. That's a complete lie. But that's important for us to see because it shows something is afoot. They're now trying to arrest an Iranian diplomat and claim that there was a terrorist ambition against Paris. That was just happening when other meetings were going on, when Zarif and the Iranians were coming over to Vienna and talking with the president of Austria, which is a very solid country against refugees and such. So there are things afoot. And coming back to U.S. Central Command, that's one of the military commands in the United States that handles all of the Middle East.
Hang on, before we get off MKO, Wayne Madsen has put out a report just in the last few days that the NATO countries have agreed with Albania that the MKO can have bases to do training there, possibly as a springboard to go into Iran. I just wondered, what can be the military point in that? And this just sounds almost unprecedented that, we've been actually setting up terrorist bases to train terrorists here in Europe.
Well, it's the freedom fighter nonsense once again. It's the lie that we're creating freedom fighters that are going to be returning to liberate Iran for the oppression of the government that currently occupies it, from the religious leaders that currently occupy it. And it's nonsense. It's very similar to the Sandinistas and the Contras that we had in the 80s. This lie, this propaganda, this delusion of creating freedom fighters that are going to go back and overthrow Iran, and then somehow it's going to be a brand new country that is going to be a pawn of the United States. That's why we're doing it, and no doubt the U.S. is paying for these countries to establish bases. These aren't being provided by these countries out of goodwill. They're being paid by the CIA in the United States to have these bases. Everything, no doubt, is being paid and financed by the United States. And I was told this by Iranian sources, that the U.S. government is paying American companies to pull out of Iran and paying them with U.S. taxpayer dollars for the losses that they're going to grow or accumulate because of the lack of business with Iran. So you might say Coca-Cola has been called by the White House or called by the U.S. government CIA and told, you need to pull out of Iran and we'll pay you for all the lost business, which means we'll pay taxpayer dollars to Coca-Cola, which is unconstitutional. It's bribery. But that's what I was told from people in the Iranian media.
The CIA will say it's compensation, won't they?
Well, they'll say that, but I think they're getting caught in the corruption scandal with McCabe and FBI and Department of Justice all being exposed as the hypocrites and traitors they are. I think it is going to be attached to similar projects and agencies that do things like these. You can't take American companies out of Iran and pay them bribes with U.S. taxpayer dollars. American taxpayers don't give their money to Coca-Cola, and they certainly don't want another war with Iran. They're tired of these destabilization efforts. That's why they voted for Donald Trump. He promised to get out of Syria. He promised to make friends with Russia. I'm glad he's seeing that he's following our advice and creating a summit. We said this 6 months ago, have a summit with Russia in Reykjavik, Iceland. He's having it next door in Helsinki, but I'm glad to see that Trump and Putin are going to have a summit. The next thing he should do, has a second summit, is have Iran attend and have America, Russia, and Iran in a summit. America doesn't need any other country there. If you're going to play the big boy, act like the big boy. Have the American president and then have the Russian president, the Iranian president, and then bring the Chinese president and have a whole discussion about the Middle East situation. And I think the summit is a very good way, and it needs to keep Israel out of it. That was one of the walkaways that I saw when I was in Tehran. Many of the American military and intelligence people were saying Israel needs to be decoupled from all American foreign policy discussions, period. Michael Maloof, which is a great guy, I think you'd love to have him on your show, Tony. Michael Maloof was in the Pentagon, the earliest days of 9/11, and he led this discussion point that Israel being decoupled from American conversations with Russia or Syria or Iran or any other country is absolutely essential, because Israel is a spoiler and it pollutes the entire dialogue. Whereas if you remove Israel and have a dialogue between the United States and another country, just them alone, you will have much more in common. You'll find practical alternatives. You'll see the problems. You'll create solutions, and you won't have this blood poisoning feud that Israel always brings into to any of these diplomatic discussions and dialogues.
So let's get back to CENTCOM anyway, because I know it's not the only one of these parts of the unified U.S. command system. We've even got something called EUCOM. You don't have to guess that. That's the European Union
have
area.
European Command. You have Africa Command. You have U.S. Central Command. Africa Command used to be based in Europe, European Command, but now that it's separate, you have Africa Command, which Gaddafi opposed, and I think any nation should oppose it. There's no reason for the United States to be in Africa. There's really essentially no reason for the United States to be in in the Middle East either. The United States military is meant to be in the United States, period. We're not designed, and it's unconstitutional to have bases all over the world.
Okay, so what were you doing at CENTCOM, and what is CENTCOM?
Well, CENTCOM is U.S. Central Command, and it manages all of the areas of operation, and you've got quite a lot of them. I mean, you've got Egypt, Sudan, Eritrea, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Yemen, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan. That's all of the U.S. Central Command's area of operations.
So did the Americans operate in all these countries?
Well, sure. They have offices and personnel in every country. And my job is to track the financing of terrorism through all of those countries and all of those actors and all of those banks. And that's what I saw, and I reported it in shellgamewhistleblower.com in my original report in 2012.
One of the things that the CENTCOM commanders say, and various other commands, you know, EUCOM, AFRICOM, etc., is that they help with humanitarian crises and things like this. So, you know, if there's some sort of earthquake disaster, upturns a whole bunch of U.S. troops.
Well, that's a good cover, isn't it, Tony? That's a good camouflage. You always want to wear a Girl Scout uniform to pretend and show that you're not a killer. You're not dressed in a baklava with a samurai sword behind your back and a 45 caliber on your hip. Then you're going to look dangerous. But if you pretend you're a Girl Scout or a Boy Scout or whatever the common uniform is in an innocent civilian attire or a medical attire like your Doctors Without Borders, then no one's going to question you. Then you can slip in and do all sorts of, quote, humanitarian aid and intelligence gathering and targeting analysis and recruitment operations and low-intensity conflict, psychological warfare, potential publications with the media. You can plant people in the radio, in the TV sectors. You can plant intelligence agents. You can convert people. You could do all sorts of tentacle expansion operations. And that's often, sadly, what humanitarian relief is really designed to do, to be a cover for war by other means.
Okay, well, we speak to you fairly regularly, probably once every few months, Scott. I wonder if this time you could just give us one website that is to get your news from, because, I mean, we hear nowadays quite a lot of the really good websites which have got news on them are being called fake news, but we know that that's just fake news. So can you give us your website? It sounds a bit corny, but website of the week. Where's a good place to go, do you think, to go and find some real news? Because we all know now that much of, particularly when it comes to the major conflicts, what we're hearing on the mainstream press is just not the truth.
Yeah, well, I always put all of my links and news and stories on my site that's connected to YouTube, that's connected to my YouTube site and my Facebook site, and the site is www.shellgamewhistleblower.com. Shellgamewhistleblower.com, and there's the YouTube and the Facebook and the Twitter sites that people can connect to. And the best show that I've seen that really does a good analysis is Truth Versus News.
Scott Bennett, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. It's been an honor.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car or anywhere else if you like. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Roland Dye from Bristol Trident Ploughshares and former US Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett. Also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897 if you want to hire the space on Stokes Croft, or the China Shop, which is very interesting for the tourists to the city. And they're on 944540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. So, that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my own two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 to 8 p.m. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, on Dialect, goodbye for now.
Hey, little girl, comb your hair, fix your makeup. Soon he will open the door. Don't think because there's a ring on your finger, you needn't try anymore. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. I'm warning you. Day after day, there are girls at the office, and men will always be men. Don't send him off with your hair still in curlers. You may not see him again. For wives should always be lovers too. Run to his arms the moment he comes home to you. He's almost here. Little girl, better wear something pretty, something you'd wear to go to the city and dim all the lights, pour the wine, start the music. Time to get ready for love. Dim all the lights, pour the wine, start the music. Time to get ready for love. Time to get ready. Time to get ready for love. Time to get ready.